Welcome to RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange, a weekly public affairs program helping you to ask questions, find answers, and distinguish the truth from the lie. I'm Kelly O'Ramaris. Today we continue our series on energy called The End of the Age of Oil. To understand why 9/11 happened, and to understand why in October of 2002, the United States is on the brink of an imperial war of aggression against Iraq, one must understand that the world is facing an energy crisis, a crisis based not on market or political forces, but on physical reality. The world is running out of the cheap oil and natural gas that powered the 20th century. Over the next several weeks, we will explore in depth the scientific data concerning the coming shortages, the implications of this energy crisis on geopolitics and economics, possible alternative energy sources and strategies, and the impact of the end of the age of oil on human culture. This week, we continue our series with world-renowned petrogeologist Dr. Colin J. Campbell. After being awarded a Ph.D. at Oxford in 1957, Dr. Campbell joined the oil industry as an exploration geologist. His career took him to Borneo, Trinidad, Colombia, Australia, Papua New Guinea, the USA, Ecuador, the United Kingdom, Ireland, and Norway. He is now a trustee of ODAC, the Oil Depletion Analysis Center, a charitable organization in London that is dedicated to researching the date and impact of the peak and decline of world oil production due to resource constraints. ODAC is also dedicated to raising awareness of the serious consequences of peak oil. Dr. Campbell has published extensively, and his recent articles have stimulated lively debate as geologists draw different conclusions as to when the global peak in oil production will occur, if it hasn't occurred already. However, it should be noted that the differences of opinion as to the peak year are not all that far apart when one considers the need to make and implement a long-term energy policy. And no, war is not an energy policy. Dr. Campbell is one of the founders of ASPO, the Association for the Study of Peak Oil. On September 2, 2002, he spoke with Radio Internet Story Exchange by phone from his home in the west of Ireland. He was pleased to hear that just about all of the conversation would be broadcast. Normally, reporters draw him into a long conversation only to extract a few sound bites. Big mistake. In his article, Peak Oil, A Turning Point for Mankind, Campbell wrote, quote, "The reality is that there is no real reprieve. Gradually, the market, and not just the oil market, will come to realize that OPEC can no longer single-handedly manage depletion. It will be a dreadful realization because it means that there is no ceiling to oil price other than from falling demand. That, in turn, spells economic recession and a crumbling stock market, the first signs of which are already being felt." Unquote. Most media are not telling the public about this reality. And unless people come to a greater understanding of the situation soon, the world, especially the energy-guzzling United States, is in for a rude awakening. Why don't we just get started with some basic definitions of things? Maybe a brief telling of who M. King Hubbert was and what the Hubbert curve and what the Hubbert peak is and what peak oil is?
Well, the answer really is that when you consider oil and gas, everybody's agreed it's a fossil fuel, which means that it was formed in the geological past. That means we have a certain amount of the stuff. And in the same way as any beer drinker knows, the glass starts full and it ends empty. And this is a fact of nature. Well, M. King Hubbert was a very brilliant scientist in many regards, quite apart from this subject. And I think in those early days in 1956 and before when he made his studies, he had a pretty good idea of what the endowment of oil in the United States was. And that wasn't so difficult because the peak of discovery in the States was in 1930. And so on the, I suspect rather on the back of the envelope, he said, well, if there's just so much of the stuff, and probably the peak will come at the halfway point because it obviously has to rise gently and decline gently due to the physics of the reservoir. So it made eminent good sense to say peak comes at the halfway point. And he probably sketched out a kind of a bell curve, and he found it fit pretty well with the production to date, which was back in 56. And he said, well, if we continue on this trajectory, we get to the midpoint or the peak around 1970, which is precisely when it happened. So that's essentially the background of Harvard and the depletion of a finite resource. But what is interesting, really, is that the example of the United States, the old onshore United States, which is the most mature area of all, is now being reflected around the world in one country after the other. So we only really have to look at the experience of the United States to see the path that less depleted countries will take.
Give me, in general, the workings of the physics of an oil field. Why is it that the peak of production occurs around the midpoint?
Well, first of all, let's talk about discovery. You know, when you open a new area, when a government in some country opens a new area to exploration, the oil companies go in there, they know very little about it, and they shoot seismic surveys. Now, these surveys could be compared with, let's say, an X-ray of a patient. You get a scan of the Earth so you can see the detailed geology thousands of feet underground. And they find prospects, places that have a large number of different criteria, all have to come together in the right place. You need the structure, you need the right time of the oil migration, you need the seal, you need a lot of things to come together. And so the oil companies then find these things, and that's what the job of explorers is, and then they poke some holes in them to see what they give. Well, sometimes they fail, just don't have the right geology. And after a certain number of such tests, the companies will likely say, well, this place just doesn't have it. In other cases where it does have it, well, then the larger fields are found first for very obvious reasons. They're too big to miss, and they're the first prospects to be tried. So you get the big fields come in soon, and once you find one, it's relatively easy to find the next one because you know what you're looking for. And so you get this pattern of a large surge of discovery rising up, and then as it gradually declines, as the smaller and smaller fields are left. Well, this pattern of discovery is then reflected in the pattern of production that obviously in some measure has to match the pattern of discovery. You have to find it before you produce it. Of course, now if you turn to an individual oil field, the pattern isn't necessarily a peak at the midpoint because you found it, you start drilling wells, so production rises, and it's normal to set the maximum production at a certain level. Nobody's putting all those facilities in just for a few months. So it normally rises up, it has a plateau of a few years, and then towards the end of the plateau, the engineers work as hard as they can to find every little nook and cranny there that might have been missed earlier on there. Using advanced technology, they're doing everything they possibly can to hold the plateau as high as possible. And then eventually you reach the end of the plateau and she falls off relatively steeply at 10-20% a year, let's say. So that's the normal pattern. And to going back to the bell curve of Hubbard, when you have a large population of fields, not all found at the same time, by some statistical law we don't have to go into, the average of these different profiles ends up as more or less a symmetrical bell-shaped curve. So certainly not everything follows the bell curve exactly, but this is a good rule of thumb way to look at it.
So when we talk about the world peak of oil production, we're talking about a global average?
Well, when one has to look at every country individually and then sum them up and get the answer, but the world situation is confused because of the OPEC countries that for the last 30 years or so have been producing at below their capacity. So instead of having a simple bell curve, which had the whole world been, let's say, like Texas, then we would have had a high peak back in the 90s and a steep fall. But in fact, the OPEC countries and some others for various reasons didn't produce at the maximum that they could have done. That meant that the peak is lower and later than it would otherwise have been. And that also means that the subsequent decline is not quite as steep as it would have been had we just gone hell for leather at everything. So it's a complicated story. You just can't make it too simple in all of this. But the general pattern is fairly clear now, I think.
So what's going on right now, though, is that a lot of numbers are being tossed about in public debate about world oil production peaking sometime between now and the year 2010. Maybe it's even peaked already. What do we mean by that?
Well, we enter politics here, really. This is a very extraordinary situation that here the whole wide world depends on oil. I mean, you've only got to look out of the window and see the traffic of burning up oil at a prodigious rate. But the public statistics are extremely unreliable. First, you have things called proved reserves. Now, proved reserves are reserves reported by oil companies for financial purposes under the Securities and Exchange Commission rules. Now, these are very conservative estimates. They're absolutely sure they have this. They don't reflect what they expect to have when the fields come to an end. This is a conservative, low financial number to avoid fraud. But and then there are proved and probable reserves, which are not put in the public domain, which should reflect what the fields actually contain. And then you have the OPEC countries that exaggerated what they had because they were vying with each other for quota based on reserves. So the problem in studying this question, there is really no particular difficulty in understanding the nature of depletion. It's fairly obvious. The problem is to get good data. And the oil companies themselves are obliged under the stock exchange rules to report very conservative numbers. That means they've got they've had in the past an inventory of underreported reserves that they can bring in gradually that gives them a better image and is good for all sorts of reasons. And there's nothing wrong with doing so. That's just the practice of the business. It's not a complicated question to understand. It's complicated to give a clear answer because the data is so unreliable. There's a lot of different kinds of oil. There's a great difference between a Middle East well or a Texas well flowing at 20, 30, 40,000 barrels a day and digging up a tar sand in Canada, which is a slow and laborious process. So there's a great range of different kinds of oil, and these are not properly distinguished either in the database, so that one is often comparing apples and pears. So we are living in this situation of extreme confusion about the data. The measurement itself is not particularly difficult. So if we employed a detective to somehow dig through all of this and get together good evidence, I think he would find that the share coming from the Middle East is set to rise, and it will probably exceed what they can in practice do by around 2010. So I would picture of the conventional oil, so-called the easy, cheap stuff. We would have a plateau now from about now to 2010, and then it would begin its terminal decline. But superimposed on that, we have new production from the deep water area that'll rise quite rapidly and then fall off equally rapidly. We have some polar oil, and then we have the heavy oils from Canada and Venezuela that will grow very slowly because it's sort of a mining process to dig this stuff up. Putting all that together, really, I think we have a global peak of all liquids around 2010. That means that production needn't fall below present levels for about 20 years. But as this peak arises, I think the world as a whole and the financial community and company planners and even the governments will realize that it's coming, and they'll see that we really face a very different world where this, insofar as the past prosperity of the world has been driven by a cheap, abundant oil-based energy, we now reach the peak of this stuff, and it gradually declines, and it certainly becomes more expensive, not because it costs more to produce, but because the scarcity is because most of it is coming from the Middle East and some from Russia. So we face really an enormous turning point in the history of man, in a sense, where the world that we have known is facing some kind of discontinuity, and life's going to be a little bit different, I think.
There do seem to be questions about how much oil is where, and you brought up Russia, the Caspian Sea Basin. There does seem to be some sort of quarrel about the estimates of what really is there or not. How do you go about figuring out scientifically how much is there?
Well, you're absolutely right. The Caspian area is one of the oldest oil-producing areas in the world, so it was no surprise there was oil there, and the Soviets didn't explore the offshore because they had no particular reason to do so. And so when this area was opened up, and of course it's confused by a lot of different countries there, Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan and so forth, there was some wildly optimistic estimates of what this offshore area might yield. Some numbers as high as 200 billion barrels were spoken of, based on nothing much more than just a kind of optimistic guess. And for a while, it was said, oh, well, the Caspian's going to offset the control of the Middle East, maybe even another whole source of oil, so no longer are we victims, so to speak, of what the Middle East may do. Anyway, that's how it started, and now we're at least 10 years into this phase, and it's been disappointing. In Azerbaijan, there's a number of fields have been found offshore Azerbaijan, but they're small. There have been disappointments. Now ExxonMobil has decided to pull out. Then in the northern Caspian, well, I won't get into the technical details of this, but there was a huge structure there that was seen on the seismic in the northern Caspian, and it looked rather like the Tengiz field onshore that Chevron is now developing. And so there were extremely high hopes for this thing, but now they've drilled, I think, 3 wells into it, and far from being a 100 billion barrel category, they now talk of 8 to 13, I think, the last numbers. So the thing is a nice oil field by all means, but it isn't going to make any fundamental difference to the world picture. And also from that group, 2 major companies, BP and the Norwegian company Statoil, withdrew. So when companies pull out of something, you have to say it isn't quite as good as one hoped. So I think the idea of the Caspian, and of course talking of politics, is, I don't know how true it is, of course, but there's a lot of rumor and suggestion going around that there's quite a U.S. military interest in that region. They have military bases now in various of these countries roundabout. There's been a lot of discussion about pipeline routes, how to get it out. We've had, of course, the Afghan war, which some people say was related in some way to a pipeline route. I think many of these things are exaggerated, but there might be an undercurrent of strategic planning by the United States on the hope of being able to control this source of foreign oil that it so desperately needs, because its own supply has been falling for the last 40 years, roughly. So I think there has been, and there probably still is, a lot of politics around the dream, you could say, now, I think, in the face of reality, of an enormous amount of Caspian oil.
You are listening to RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange. This is the second in our series on the end of the age of oil. Today's topic is peak oil, featuring Dr. Colin J. Campbell, a trustee of the Oil Depletion Analysis Center and a founder of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil. Another aspect of politics seems to be the U.S. Geological Survey's estimates of when peak production will occur. What do you think of their data?
Well, of course, the USGS is a very reputable, fine institution that everybody would respect. And from the oil crises of the 1970s, it started to make assessments of world resources and reserves in different countries. And they did a lot of good scientific work. And for many years, they put out really very sensible studies. Every 3 years, they'd issue their final findings. But now, in the year 2000, a new team took over, and there's a radical change from the past. Now they have extremely exaggerated estimates. Again, it's a complicated story because they have a range of high probability and low probability from which they calculate the mean. But a simple way to demonstrate that the study is flawed is to say that their mean estimate of what is going to be found and produced, one assumes, in the period of 30 years from 1995 to 2025, works out on average now at 24 billion barrels a year. And the actual results, now 7 years into the study period, have been less than half this, when you would expect the larger fields to come in first. So really there is no credibility left in that study as such, and there are a number of sort of bizarre anomalies in what they proposed. But I don't want to criticize them too much. They did it in a kind of abstract geological assessment, and they didn't make any pronouncements about how many wildcat wells it would take to find what they proposed. They didn't extrapolate past trends to really take into account the experience in the real world. It was rather an academic kind of study. And now, whether there were political motives to issue such a thing, I don't know. There are some hints that there may have been some politics involved, but as is normal, one never can know for sure.
I had heard that part of the problem with their data set is that they count oil that has a low probability of actually being recovered.
Well, they have this range of probability from, take the example of an untested, unknown basin in East Greenland, for example. They say there's a 95% probability of finding more than zero, is the way it's put. That means there's at least one barrel. And then they say there's a 5% chance of there being more than 112. Well, when you think about it, what in God's name does a 5% chance of something being bigger than some particular quoted number, which is simply a guess? I mean, they didn't have the seismic. There's no wells drilled there. Nobody really knows. So it's an absolute guess. And yet they had to give some kind of number. And then out of this range, they computed the mean value, which then fed into the world totals. I don't exactly criticize them for what they did, but I don't really think you can take the results very seriously.
So how precise is the science of estimating how much oil is in a given place?
Well, in an oil field, there's no particular problem, you know. Today's seismic is a very high resolution. You can see the structure in extreme detail. There's a great deal of knowledge about the physics of the reservoir, the behavior of the reservoir. So there's no particular technical problem in making a good estimate. Now, what you report is another matter, because a large field will have several phases of development, obviously, and they've got to match the investment against the profit and the production rates and so forth. So they start with, let's say, one platform on it, and they would report the reserves attributable to the wells on that platform. Now, that itself doesn't say anything particular about the field as a whole. And as time passes, well, the reserves are revised upwards, and eventually they come back pretty close to what the explorers estimated from a volumetric standpoint of looking at the geology at the beginning. Nothing was really added in any real sense, and nor can it be, because the field was filled in the geological past, so it has what it has.
So it seems that the issue is estimating what you've got. Let me go back and ask a definitional thing. You mentioned heavy oil in Canada and Venezuela. What's heavy oil and what's it useful for in the practical world?
Well, in the geological basin, oil migrates upwards, and it flows up to the shallow depths around the edges of the basin. And when it gets to the shallow levels, it's attacked by bacteria and it's weathered, and the light fractions, because oil is a complex molecule, the light fractions evaporate and are lost, so you're left with a tarry, sticky substance, which is variously called tar sands or bitumen or extra heavy oil. Now, this stuff, in the case of Canada, it lies under an overburden of about 75 meters maximum, so they've got to dig away 75 meters of rock above it, then they get down to this sand with huge mechanical shovels. They dig the stuff up, then they've got to centrifuge it and separate the oil or the tar from the sand grains to which it's sticking. Then they've got to add caustic soda, and they've got to do various procedures and various practices to convert this heavy goop into a light synthetic oil. And they use a lot of fuel, incidentally, in the process. These plants need fuel to drive them. And at the end of the day, you get out a perfectly satisfactory light oil. And there's a huge amount of this tar sand in the ground. The problem is the cost of extracting it, including the environmental cost, because you leave behind these huge pits, and also the rate. You simply can't dig the stuff up very quickly. And so I think that this is an important resource for the future. I think that production will expand, but it won't have much impact on peak, but it will ameliorate slightly the decline after peak. Venezuela is a slightly different case, but I won't go into that just now. But I think that gives you the picture. It's a valuable resource. It's a very large resource in nature, but the extraction rate is extremely costly and extremely slow.
Which then drives up the price of oil and all of the finished goods that we make with it.
Well, the price, the two things, the cost and the price are two different things. I mean, surely it costs more to produce the heavy oil than it does, let's say, a Middle East well. But the price of oil is primarily set by the producing governments and also the consuming governments in many countries in the tax that they impose on the product. So I think that the rise in the cost, the rise in the price of oil for the consumer will in the future be primarily driven by the growing shortage, by the control of the dwindling supplies by relatively few countries.
I have something here from something you wrote in Mabendi.com, and it said that capacity limits were breached late in 2000, causing prices to soar, leading to world recession. What is a capacity limit?
Well, you know, producing oil isn't just a case of opening the tap. Think a little bit about the Middle East at this point. Here they have these huge fields found more than 50 years ago, and the flush production out of these fields has already been taken. So to add production from those countries involves infill drilling, putting extra wells in between the old ones. It involves a great deal of work of reconfiguring wells and working them over, and there's equipment fails, it's got to be replaced. So it's a long, long haul to be able to add significant amounts of new production. They've got to run faster to stand still, in a sense, because the easy stuff is going. So when people speak of spare capacity, again, we enter a definitional problem. I would say that at the end of 2000, there was precious little spare capacity that could be turned on simply by opening a valve. Of course, there was more capacity that could be added with work, time, and investment, but that isn't what we were talking about. And this market reacts to the marginal barrel. So if there's a small shortage or a small surplus, the price of oil fluctuates rather widely. And so I think what happened is that in the late 2000, we were approaching this limit. I mean, it's not cast in stone, but the brokers and the traders looking at their screens could see there was not much surplus capacity available to meet the needs. And so the price of oil started going up through the roof. It went up through the 30s, and I personally thought it would go on up because I felt that there was no additional supply that could be brought on. But in fact, the recession came and the demand for oil fell. And as it fell, of course, it put demand in better balance with the supply, and pressure on prices diminished. Now, this sort of introduces a kind of vicious circle, because if the economy were to recover, then oil demand would rise in parallel until it again hit this ceiling, which itself is declining, which again would have a high oil price shock, which in turn would reimpose recession in a kind of sequence that is a sort of a vicious circle.
I have with me the conventional oil endowment table with the 64 countries.
Yeah.
And it appears that while we are talking about a global peak of production coming very soon, relatively speaking, that the different countries peak at different times, and then there's this midpoint of depletion. Can you tell me what the midpoint of depletion is?
Well, the midpoint of depletion is simply a mathematical number, which is half the total endowment. The total endowment being what has been produced, reserves, and what is yet to find, as far as you can estimate these things. And it's, as a working model, it's not set in stone, but as a working model, you can say, and pragmatic, practical experience shows it to be the case, you can say that peak production comes at, or usually before, the midpoint. So you look at mature countries in the case of the United States is perhaps the best example. It came flat at the midpoint in 1970, when half the total endowment of the U.S. 48 states was produced. Alaska and the deep water are to be regarded as separate provinces for this purpose. Take a look at Germany. Its peak came a little bit before the midpoint, and it's being in terminal decline now for many years. Look at Britain. It peaked in 1999, quite recently, but it's now falling about 6% a year, and there really isn't any hope that this trend can be reversed. So the North Sea, which was such an important producer over the last 20 years, countering the influence from the Middle East, it's reached this peak now, more or less. And in 10 years, production from the North Sea will be half what it is today. And this, in turn, of course, puts greater pressure on the places that still do have some left.
And I can't help but notice that on this list of midpoints to depletion, the one that's the furthest out in this list of 64 countries is Iraq, with an expectation that the peak of production will be in 2021 and the midpoint of depletion will be in 2030. And the other countries that are even close to it are 2026, one of them being Abu Dhabi, another one being Kazakhstan. And of course, we're just talking about we're not sure what's in the Caspian Basin. I would assume this midpoint of depletion has to do with how fast you're using it. Is it possible then that these sanctions that have been on Iraq for over a decade are kind of stretching out the midpoint of depletion time?
Well, absolutely. It's a strange irony that these sanctions, in fact, were really kind of a blessing to the long-term future of Iraq, because instead of pumping the stuff away as if there was no tomorrow, they were prevented from doing so. That meant that there's more left for the future. That means it will last longer. And, of course, as the price goes up in the future, the financial benefit to Iraq of not having produced so much oil in the cheap days will actually come to their benefit if there are any Iraqis left by then. But you can consider the five Middle East countries, that is Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, Abu Dhabi and Kuwait. These are the countries that own about half of what is left. They are all clustered around the Persian Gulf there. They have a lot in common, and they basically control the amount of oil that OPEC will produce. So it's not easy to model exactly what they'll do in the future. But as you rightly say, if they produce less today, there's more tomorrow. That means their control of world supply is inexorably rising.
Well, that assumes that they themselves are able to maintain control of their own supplies. We seem to be on the verge of war with Iraq. It would seem to me that we have the likelihood now of more war as the countries that are running out of cheap, pumpable oil are looking more and more to the one place that has it.
This is a very sensitive question you ask, but I think many people think that the United States has a not-so-hidden oil agenda behind this threatened invasion of Iraq.
We do have oil men occupying the White House right now.
That's what I understand, but it's a very strange situation. I think many people in the world question what is being done, and I'm sure there are many tyrants around the world, but this particular one is the man who's got the oil. And I think that isn't lost on many people.
Number 20 on this list of conventional oil endowment is the N zone. What's that?
Oh, neutral zone.
Oh, what's that?
Neutral zone is a tract of territory which is jointly owned by Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. None of the borders in the Middle East are that firm. And so the border between Kuwait and Saudi Arabia was uncertain. And in the 50s or thereabouts, Getty, I think, was the man who made an agreement between the two governments to exploit this zone in between. And it's interesting that we mentioned the neutral zone. You know, if you look at the numbers, the reported reserves of all of those countries, you had this enormous jump at the late 1980s. And the one, which was very implausible, and the one place that didn't announce such a vast increase was indeed the neutral zone, because it was owned by two different governments, and they had no reason to exaggerate. So that's the neutral zone.
I saw this table about implausible reporting. I guess we're going back to the reporting issue again. This was rather disturbing. Declared reserves for this group of nations, which were OPEC nations, including Venezuela, minus what you called spurious claims. And you're saying that fully 45% of the above reserve claims were questionable?
Yeah, well, what happened is this, is that in 1985, I guess it was, Kuwait overnight added 50% to its reported reserves. Nothing was found or nothing changed in the reservoir. This was just what they reported. And, of course, they did so in order to increase their OPEC quota, which was based on reserves. They were cheating, to put it bluntly. And, of course, this depressed the price of oil, and it affected what the other countries could produce. Then next came Venezuela in 1987, who again added, I think it doubled its reserves overnight, as I remember, from 27 to 54. And it did so by the inclusion of all of this heavy oil that had been known for years, but that had previously not been included in the reserve base. So their action then got more quota for Venezuela, and that caused, in turn, the other Middle East countries, Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Iran, and Iraq, to announce enormous overnight increases, followed a little bit later by Saudi Arabia itself. And none of this resulted from any discovery being made in the late 80s. It was simply a reporting phenomenon. But, and as you notice in the table probably, many of these numbers have stayed implausibly constant ever since. I mean, is it likely that Iraq, we were talking about Iraq a moment ago, has stuck at 112 billion barrels for 30 years, you know? It's just most implausible that the reserves would stay unchanged while production goes ahead. But the situation isn't quite as simple as it seems either, because the earlier numbers were too low, having been inherited from the private companies before they were expropriated, so some upward revision was called for. The point is that nothing happened in the late 80s, and whatever the revision is has to be backdated to the date on which the fields were found, which was up to 50 years before. Now, this backdating issue has an enormous impact on the discovery trend, obviously. If you find more earlier, it means you find less later. And this is one of the reasons that has so misled many analysts, who have been misled into seeing this growth of reserves, which they think can be extrapolated ever onward, when in fact the revisions should be backdated to the discovery of the fields concerned to get a genuine trend, which gives an entirely different picture.
So in other words, just to grab some simple numbers, if when you discovered an oil field, let's say in 1980, and you thought it had 100 million barrels of oil, and in 1990, due to better technology, you find out that it has 150 million barrels, you should go back to your figures for 1980 and say this oil field has 150 million barrels.
Yes, exactly. I mean, the oil field was found when it was found, even if you didn't know exactly what was in it. Obviously, I mean, the discovery is the it's like being born. Nothing happens unless you are born. And so even if you take a very cautious first estimate, which naturally grows over time, or in some special cases there might be some particular technology that you have to use to get the oil, but however it happens, you've got to put the size back to the discovery of the field if you want to get a genuine discovery trend. And I spoke about this earlier, the world discovery peaked in the mid-60s. So this is when the discovery of oil, with proper backdating, as I described, reached a peak and has been falling fast ever since. And as we said earlier, we're finding about one barrel for every four we use of conventional and about one of every three for all kinds of oil.
You are listening to RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange. We now return you to Dr. Cullen J. Campbell on peak oil.
It seems, you know, better technologies and honest mistakes notwithstanding, that a lot of this has the feel of the book cooking that's making the headlines in the American corporate world.
It's not exactly false accounting. Just to explain this a bit better, perhaps, these rules that apply to the definition of proved reserves go back to the early days in the United States. And in the United States, unlike any other country, the oil rights are owned by the landowner. That meant that the ownership of oil fields in Texas or wherever was highly fragmented. So each man had his little part of this field. And when he reported his reserves, all he could report fairly and reasonably and correctly was what his own wells would deliver. So the and of course in the early days there was all kinds of promoters and people who exaggerated. So the SEC moved to make these very strict rules to say, well, what you can report is what is behind pipe in your existing wells. Now this only said what he had in his particular field and one in his particular part of the field. And so one man might have drilled more wells or one man might have drilled less. There was no field-wide numbers to work with, and it was irrelevant in those days. So this is the origin of this very bad accounting procedures that we now have. I couldn't stress it more. The whole uncertainty relating to this figure is not a technical question of determining what the reserves are. It is the method by which they're reported. And, of course, the oil industry, I wouldn't say it was exactly a conspiracy, but it certainly helped them to be able to underreport the size of discovery, hold it, so to speak, in the cupboard, and let it out gradually over time. It reduced their tax. It presented a better image of a smooth build-up of assets rather than one champagne party and then 10 lean years or something. So it turned out as a fairly as a pragmatic, sensible way to manage it. And for most purposes, it doesn't in the least matter. It is only when we want to look at this issue of peak and decline on a world scale or for a particular country that we need the right numbers and we need the right dates. Otherwise, it doesn't really matter.
Well, it sounds like it's mattering a lot now if the world peak is fairly soon. What are the implications of reaching the production peak?
Well, it's probably the most important issue facing the world today. One looks back now, even my lifetime, one can see the enormous expansion in the production of oil. Every city is choked with traffic. The skies are full of vapor trails. Agriculture is interesting. You know that the world population has increased sixfold, almost exactly in parallel with the production of oil, because you use a lot of oil for mechanized farming, for irrigation, for pesticides, even nutrients. And so we have lived for the past 100 years or so in this world that is effectively driven by this abundant supply of cheap energy from oil. It's as if we had 20 or 30 slaves working for us. So now we're about to reach the peak of this and see the decline begin. We're not going to run out of oil for an awful long time, but we are going to see it getting less and less available, more and more expensive. And so we just face a fundamental change in the way we live. And it's very difficult for governments or indeed anybody to kind of grasp this and react in some sensible fashion. You know, governments don't get many votes for anticipating problems. They prefer the problems to come and then they can react. So this is one of the situations that is unfolding that does need really firm government policy, which so far isn't there.
It also seems to need a lot of long-range planning, which seems to be in short supply politically and in business these days.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I'm a little bit out of my depth on this, but it seems to me that the way the investment community has worked, that they built up a kind of economic, a virtual economy that built on financial manipulations and financial assets that are not really backed by anything substantive. And I think we've seen the start of this collapse of the stock market where these excesses are being removed. But as the basic energy that drives the economy, and especially the United States, does become in short supply and in greater cost, then I think you really do face a really deep recession. I mean, we may be looking at something that's quite as bad as the Depression of the 30s.
You did refer to the fact that there does seem to be a kind of disconnect in economic analysis between what the markets are doing and what the resource depletion is really saying.
That's right. I mean, the price of oil is set on this very small margin, a small surplus or a small shortage has a completely disproportionate impact on the price. And these prices are set on a daily basis of people looking at screens. There's nobody anywhere thinking about what's going to be available 10 years out, you know. So it is a very short-term market, but then the whole economic fabric we live in is very short-term as far as I can understand it.
There is also the fact that there's no real perfect substitute for oil in certain things. I mean, I'm sure there are people who would love to get rid of the petrochemically derived pesticides and go to organic farming. But on the other hand, let's say plastics, I I can do without maybe plastic dishes and knives and forks, but a ceramic computer, just I don't see that happening. Where do you think we need to put our oil resources, and what are the more likely alternatives that we can turn to?
Well, I think the first step in reacting to this situation is to use less. I mean, that's a very obvious thing, and I would say that the world today, especially the developed countries, are extremely wasteful in their use. I mean, you know, we had a great improvement in engine efficiency when the internal combustion engine was developed, and it's been refined over the years. But now it goes backwards because the thing is stationary, choked in traffic. That isn't an efficient use of the fuel. So although we have the efficient tools to use it well, the way we live makes us extremely inefficient in the use of energy generally. Look at housing. We switch the switch when we want some light without really giving it a second thought. So I think the primary thing to try to achieve out of this is to make people in their own daily lives more aware of this whole energy issue and try to design their lives in some way to use less and to be more efficient and to really see this situation for what it is. And as we proceed, well, we just have to get used to using less of the stuff, and I'm afraid it does speak of an end of the kind of affluence that people have known, because although you can make electricity out of wind, you can have solar electricity or solar heating, even here in the west of Ireland, we as the kind of gesture have solar hot water here. You can do it, but it can't come close to matching the abundant energy provided by oil and gas. We haven't said much about gas, incidentally, and that, I don't know if you want to get into gas, tell me.
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, gas depletes very differently from oil, you know. Gas is a gas and oil is a liquid. So if you put a well into a gas accumulation and opened it fully, you would deplete it very fast. So this means that in practice, talking of the United States now, the offtake of gas wells was capped at far below their natural capacity. This gave them a great deal of inbuilt spare capacity, and it was produced at the capacity of the pipelines. Well, they've now more or less come to the end of this plateau, and they're drilling extremely high level of new drilling of gas wells, but they no longer have this cushion of underproducing them. They produce them at maximum rate, and they are depleted in a matter of months now. So the United States really is coming to the end of its gas plateau, and there's nothing they can do about it. They're already relying heavily on Canada and further afield. And this just gets worse and worse, and the decline of gas is really quite steep. When it ends abruptly. And in the meantime, a huge amount of electricity generating capacity has turned from coal to gas because it was cheaper and because it was environmentally better. And so, really, I think the United States faces a really serious electricity generating problem, and quite soon over this. And you can't transport gas across oceans very easily. You can, of course, you can liquefy it in tankers, but that's a slow, costly business too. So gas is, in a way, a more extreme situation than oil, that depletes slowly just because of the physics of the reservoir.
This all seems very pessimistic. I mean, would you say, for example, that there's not enough cheap oil left to allow the developing nations to fully industrialize and have a comparable standard of living to, say, where you are in Ireland today?
No, there's no hope in the world of them being able to match the I don't know about standard of living. It's a bit of a subjective concept, but I mean, people can live fairly happily in rather simple conditions, but there is no possibility of the third world countries ever achieving the high energy use that the United States does, for example. I mean, look at China, for example. There are huge numbers of people living there who aspire to have being the two-car family, but there just is no hope in the world that this is possible.
And also, it seems some of the alternatives, for example, wood burning. I understand they had that big brown cloud in Asia, and there are very severe environmental problems there, and that part of the problem isn't just what we're doing and it blowing over there, but things like burning forests, burning wood, even that's not environmentally friendly.
No.
Is the problem that there are just too many people on the planet?
Yeah, I guess that is the prime problem. Of course, you know, you can have more people living at a very subsistence level, and they don't do as much, don't have so much impact as a smaller number of wealthy people. So, it's a complicated issue, but yeah, I think it is. Well, I don't know whether everybody would think that this progression that we've seen, let's see, over the last 20 or since the last war, let's say, of ever more cars and ever bigger this and ever bigger that, and consumerism run wild, whether anybody, quite apart from what we've been talking about, could really see that going on forever, you know. Things normally, what goes up eventually comes down, you know. So there are these cycles, and I think it's a bit unrealistic to think that, you know, there's going to be just one big shopping mall end of Africa to the other.
Nor would we want it, and I would think the Africans wouldn't want that either.
No.
On the other hand, here's an example. We're getting a lot of commercials, again, here in the United States, at least in the Bay Area, from the American Plastics Council, talking about the wonderful things that are made with plastic and how they can keep you safe and healthy, and they show you IV bags in hospitals and things like that. And will Africa be able to raise its standards of living in terms of better health and the kinds of things, the good things that modern technology gives you, in order to, you know, have the kinds of healthy lives that we take for granted if there's not going to be cheap oil?
I don't know is the answer, but I don't know on what they're going to. No, I don't think it's at all possible, frankly, to be straight about it. Without this abundant source of cheap energy, you have to go back to fairly simple farming methods and local communities, which in a certain sense may, you know, one benefit coming out of this, much of the difficult conditions in the world are urban degradation in the third world. So these cities are made possible by cheap transport that feeds them. Well, if this is no longer possible, you might find people moving back to more rural conditions, or admittedly fairly simple rural conditions, but they might at least be pleasanter ones than living in some gruesome slum somewhere. So I guess there's a certain upside to this. It's not all doomsday.
It occurred to me that the lack of cheap energy and the kinds of transport that we take for granted in the UK or the U.S., would even change our concepts of time and how we use it if we're perhaps back to horses?
Well, yes, I would agree with you in a way. You know, I live in a little Irish village here, and you talk to some of the old people here, and you say, well, do you think things have got better? And their immediate reaction is, oh, yes, of course they have. Then you ask them a second question, you say, well, was it bad before? And they say, well, we were very poor, and you know, we had hardly anything, but no, it wasn't bad. We enjoyed our lives, and, you know, we found a way to live in a fairly good equilibrium with what we had. And it's true even to this day. There's a sort of sense of community in this village that is rather unusual. So I think there are some pluses that come out of a less consumeristic style of life, I suppose.
Well, one last question. Yeah. I know it's getting late, and you're part of the world.
My best friend is 47 years old, as am I, and she has two daughters. One is 9 and one is 6. They live in New Jersey. When they get to be their mother's age, what kind of a world do you think they'll have in terms of energy?
Well, how many years is that?
Let's say about 40 years.
40 years? Well, it's almost impossible to picture the... I think in the United... Well, talk about the United States. I would imagine that you will find people will move back to be their focus of life, will be in their local communities. I would imagine that the states, the individual states, will have a stronger role in the way they run things. And you may find in New England somewhere a small community living much as it did in the 19th century, let's say. I was incidentally asked to talk in Hawaii not so long ago, and Hawaii, which used to make pineapples and various things like that, now relies almost totally on tourism, apparently. So you take the case of Hawaii, well, they'll have to go back to growing pineapples again, I guess. And they probably become more independent as they do that. So I would foresee that you would have a growth of local communities which have a stronger voice in how they actually lived, and they probably find some ways to do so, but won't be easy, I guess.
Indigenous cultures would have an advantage if they weren't already destroyed.
Well, yes, exactly. I mean, I've spent much of my life with primitive people in all kinds of countries, and you know, they're not unhappy, these so-called primitive people. They have their lives and they live within the world that they know, and you know, I've found them to be generally a fairly cheerful group of people to be with. So I wouldn't say it was a hopeless situation, no.
Dr. Colin Campbell, thank you very much.
Well, I don't know. All right, you're welcome.
This has been RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange, a weekly public affairs program helping you to ask questions, find answers, and distinguish the truth from the lie. You've been listening to world-renowned petrogeologist Dr. Colin J. Campbell on the subject of peak oil. Dr. Campbell spoke to Radio Internet Story Exchange from his home in the west of Ireland on September 2, 2002. A collection of his writings for lay readers can be found at www.oilcrisisoneword.com. He will contribute an article to an upcoming edition of the monthly newsletter From the Wilderness, published by Michael C. Rupert. From the Wilderness can be found at www.fromthewildernessoneword.com. This interview with Dr. Campbell was the second part of a multi-part series on energy titled The End of the Age of Oil. Next week's Radio Internet Story Exchange will look at energy alternatives with writers Jeremy Rifkin and Dale Allen Pfeiffer. Radio Internet Story Exchange is produced by myself, Kelly O'Ramaris, in part at the studios of radio station KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, California. The website for RISE is www.riseforenews.net. That's RISE, the number 4, news.net. RISE programs are available on demand at the RISE website, at radioforall.net, and at indymedia.org. The programs are webcast on the news stream of Partytown Streaming Network, www.partytown.com/radio. Radio Internet Story Exchange can now be heard on From Another Angle at community radio station WRPI, Troy, New York, 91.5 FM, every Wednesday from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Welcome, WRPI. Radio Internet Story Exchange receives no corporate or foundation funding and depends on you for support. For more information on donating to RISE, receiving or publicizing the program, or giving feedback on programs, please email kellia@riseforenews.net. That's kellia@riseforenews.net. This has been Radio Internet Story Exchange. Thanks for listening.